How many of you have siblings? It's a mixed blessing, really, right? I mean, on the one hand, amazing. On the other hand, oh my God, right? Not the only one? It's good. So I was 2 and a half when my sister came along. That's us. We were dressed for this moment. I was really excited about her. I was excited about being a big brother, and for the most part, our relationship was pretty great. But I think the thing with siblings, though, is even if you have a pretty great relationship with them, it can go from, like, peace-filled fields to World War III in about 3 seconds, right? You kind of know how to poke each other. You know how to get under each other's nerves. One of the things that my sister was known for when she was growing up, she had the nickname Whaley Kaylee. Because she cried a lot. I liked calling her that. Didn't help the situation. But one of the other things she was known for was that when she got into that state of emotional engagement, of anger, of sadness, of something, she had one kind of mechanism when she was young to kind of release that emotion, and that was through biting things. And those are pretty sharp teeth. And it was on not just one or two occasions that I was the target of said emotional release. But she had this other trick. You see, you know when you're with your sibling and you're starting to escalate down that road towards the fight? Tension is raising. The parents are just far enough away for plausible deniability, right? Well, my sister had this great trick. When we got to that place of heightened emotional engagement, she would raise her arm to her own mouth and bite down. And then race into the other room, showing the bite mark to my parents, crying about what I had done to her. This infuriated me. It infuriated me because at the time, both my developmental stage but also my personality meant that I was really invested in things that were right or things that were wrong. And she was lying. And so I would race after her, denying up the wall that I had anything to do with it. What's even worse, in my books, was my parents' reaction to this. Because instead of donning their CSI outfits and looking at the clear impressions that could not have been made by me because of the size of the mouth and the constellations of teeth, they did what I think what all parents do is they sidestepped the whole biting issue and focused on the whole getting along issue and told us that we just needed to work it all out. I hated that. I hated that the facts of the situation were being tossed aside for someone else's perspective. Do you ever have that experience? Where you get very upset when someone else tosses out the facts? Just doesn't seem to care about it. Like maybe you're in that work meeting and there's that one coworker that is just refusing to accept the realities of the situation. Like no matter what data and evidence you put in front of them, they just don't accept it. Or maybe it's when you're on Facebook and that one person, that friend from high school, posts yet another article from a disreputable news source. And you find yourself already on Snopes, ready to passive-aggressively copy-paste that they're wrong. No one else does that. Or maybe that moment when the facts are just jettisoned when you read an article about the chief of the Environmental Protection Agency, Scott Pruitt. Mr. Pruitt, of course, refuses to believe that there is a link between CO2 in the atmosphere and climate change. saying we need to continue to review and analyze what is scientific consensus. I don't know about you, but I get quite upset when these sorts of facts that are not trivial, but are about our very survival, are just cast aside. As the tides are rising, as droughts linger, the real consequences of climate change are being ignored, I just want to yell, facts matter. It's not all relative. You can't just have your own facts. I think it is important for us to keep our eyes on facts. But I think it's also important for us to take a step back in these moments and realize when our so-called facts are actually just perspective, right? I think sometimes we get these things confused. We get into these heated moments where it's more important to be right or feel right or demonstrate rightness than actually figure out what's going on. How many of you have seen the movie Apollo 13? Right, so this is about the third attempt to land on the moon by the United States. There's an explosion, taking out most of their electricity and their oxygen supply, and the crew is stranded, trying to figure out how they're going to get back home. There were many facts in that situation that they had to consider, right? Most of them have to do with science that I don't understand. But they had to figure out, how much fuel do we have? When should we burn it? Where should we direct ourselves? They had to do calculus by hand to figure out the right trajectory to get themselves home safe. And if you watch the movie, you'd know that they weren't all aligned on the right thing to do. I mean, it was emotional. They had different perspectives. They had different backgrounds. They had different experiences. All of them taking the data points, those facts that they might all agree on, and aligning them into their own perspective. I mean, there was no manual that said, in light of this specific explosion, turn to page 7. Right? They had to go beyond just fact to figure out what to do. The same thing is true for things like climate change. The facts about our climate changing is real. But there exist many different perspectives about what we should do about it. There's a perspective that says that technological innovation is going to save us. So we don't need to make deep social, political, and lifestyle reforms right now. There's a camp that says we need to change virtually our entire society, and we need to keep fossil fuels in the ground for us to be able to survive. And I'm sure there are many other different perspectives on how to combat it. Whose responsibility is it? What role should the developing world, who are coming into their industrial phase, play? There are many valid perspectives trying to line up these facts to figure out what to do, and it's not clear or simple. The challenge is when we mistake facts and perspective, and when we mistake truth and perspective. We sometimes are guilty of turning facts or perspectives into truth. Truth being this capital T harmonizing thing that accurately comprehends everything. It's very easy for any of us to try to claim that high ground because the stakes are so high if we don't get it right. And it's not just about climate change, right? It's about our relationships with each other, too. And so I think what we do in these moments is we actually minimize truth. We make truth something that can be debated and completely understood, and then we get into a battle over truth when we're actually battling over perspective, because the way I experience the world, truth, this deep understanding of it all, how it all hangs together, seems to be outside of my reach. It seems to be outside of people who are way smarter than me's reach. So I'm guessing each of us is kind of reaching and not completely, well, don't completely have it in hand. When we consider these questions about, does God exist? What's the nature of humans? What is ultimate reality? What is morally correct? All of these can't be answered with a few facts or even a few perspectives. There's something deeper that goes on. There's a deeper reality that we're trying to touch. Hilary Gardner is an actor in New York City, and she has this beautiful quote. Facts are notes and lyrics on sheet music. Truth is what the singer gives to the listener when she's brave enough to open up her heart and sing. There is something deeper in truth, something contained outside of our grasp, but yet it resonates in our soul, in our bodies. And yet, we're constantly learning what we don't know, right? I mean, take for example this question. Let's go back in time to before we knew that germs and bacteria existed, all right? So we're back then, and suddenly someone you love is sick. They're not looking too good. What do you do? Well, there's many different schools of thought around the world, right? Some of our ancient kindred thought that there were these fluids, these energies in our bodies, these humors that needed to be balanced. And so through a complex process of bloodletting and tinctures and different things, we would try to balance them to... Or maybe you thought it was about a demonic possession. And so you employed a spiritual or religious response to the sickness. And because 50% of the time we are cured naturally of these common ailments, there's some pretty good evidence that some of these things worked, right? And then suddenly we invent this thing called a microscope, and we can look at our world in a different way, and we see that it is not just filled with what we can see with our eyes, but is filled with something more. Billions and billions of these tiny things that help us and make us sick. And we couldn't see them before. And now we have an answer to this question of, oh, some of the time we're sick because of these tiny little things that we can't see. And we have a whole host of scientific discoveries that now can target it in a new way. We've advanced. We understand. There's more truth. There's more facts. But then something happens when we go back to some of these ancient practices. Like, think about acupuncture. Like, if you come from a Western perspective and you've never heard of acupuncture, and someone said, oh, you're not feeling very well, I'm going to stick a bunch of needles in you, you're not going to say, oh, that seems like a very wise thing to do. And when we evolved into this modern scientific world, we looked at some of these practices in the past and we said, oh, that's full of garbage. Why would they have ever done that? Why would you put leeches on someone's wound? And then we go and start studying it, and we see that there's very real medical benefits of some of these practices that we don't completely understand why, or we're just beginning to understand why, and truth seems to, again, have sidestepped us, that these communities knew something about the nature of the world that we could, well, we verified in a different way. It's complex, right? So this week, I just came back from Atlanta, and if you're following my Facebook feed, you know that I was at a conference of about 8,000 evangelical Christians. It was a very new experience for me. Let's see if I can give you a taste. This is pretty common. We are in an arena with 8,000 people. This up here is a rock band. Awesome music. We would sing, like, pop songs. We sang Katy Perry. And then Christian praise music. Loud. It's fantastic. But, so, I was at this conference, 8,000 evangelicals. We would move between praise and these workshops. You know, around us, you can't really see. Everyone is kind of gyrating. There are praise hands in the air. People are crying because of the emotional intensity of this experience. And it really all around, is all around this experience of being connected to Jesus and his saving message. Now, luckily, I wasn't there just by myself. I go to the next picture. I had a crew of awesome UUs from around the country. You can see Eleanor, our director of Faith Formation, was there with me, and so we sat together to help us translate the experience. Because, and if we go to the next picture, this was more like our experience. This is the row of UUs singing the praise song. Like, some of the time, we were so into it. And then some of the time, we were not. It was an experience. The purpose of this conference was, it's called the Think Orange Conference. It's an evangelical organization about family ministry. And they have a really provocative and really amazing thesis. Their thesis is that the church should partner with parents to create better futures for children. I'm on board, right? And they have this conference, this gathering every year in which there's worship and there's speakers and then there's breakouts, all of it coming together to try to understand how the church can partner with parents to create a better future for children. And the theme this year was we can do more together. And it was very powerful. We'd be sitting in these sessions, and an evangelical or Baptist leader would step up and tell this gathering of more than 19 denominations from 18 different countries that they needed to put aside their different perspectives about Christianity, and that they needed to see the church across the road not as competition, but as co-workers. The CEO of this organization, a white 60-year-old man, invited four African-American pastors up around a table, and he said to one of them, "You were the person that exposed my blind spots around race. You humbled me. You showed me that I didn't understand. And now I want you," pointing to all of them, "to have the conversation about race in this country that you have when white people aren't around, in front of 8,000 people." Wow. It was a beautiful, heartrending conversation. They are doing beautiful and important work. And me and my fellow UUs, we'd be like nodding along to the song or nodding along to the session, and then something would happen, like someone would say, and as we all know, we all here believe, even if we're different in some of the ways, by how we baptism, of how we worship, that we're all redeemed by the death and sacrifice of Jesus Christ. And we'd be like, No, we don't. And then after that, you know, you kind of like pump yourself up, you go into your next session, and I went to a workshop in which the presenter said, well, the number one indicator for the success of a child is having more than one supportive adult in their lives. And so the church should be working to make that not just a fact or a statistic, but to change that reality for every child in this nation, even if they are not Christian, that we should be putting them in relationship with supportive adults so they can prosper. And like all of the UUs were like, praise hands, right? And then we'd go from that session into another session in which the presenter preached for 45 minutes about how the fact that stars make noises means that they are praising Jesus. And the fact that whales make noises means that they are praising Jesus and birds and nebulas because the Bible said it to be true. And we'd all be sitting there being like, whales? And then, you know, we're in this 8,000 people auditorium or stadium, and he puts up these pictures of some birds, some whales, a star, and a nebula, and then he like brings out a synth pad and he starts playing these noises, and he like layers them together into this beautiful song of whales and birds and nebulas. And we're like, yeah. And then they layer a song about it all being about Jesus. And we're like, I was confronted in that moment with a particular perspective about truth. Because for the majority of this gathering, they have a very exclusive view of truth. For them, truth is defined completely within Christianity. Salvation and goodness and righteousness can only happen through Christianity, and not just Christianity, but through Jesus and his sacrifice, that the cross is a bridge between this world and the next. And for many of us, we don't have that worldview, that exclusivist worldview that says there's only one truth, and you either got it or you don't. Most of us don't share that. Well, most of us don't think we share it. Because there's another way of thinking about truth that I think you use and liberal folks are very adapt to. It's this inclusivist understanding of truth. And what I mean by that is it's this phrase that there are many paths but one destination, or that there are many ways to understand truth and we get at it through different ways. It's like that song we sung, right, about all of the different religions pointing to the same place, that we may believe different things or experience different things, but there's an essential unity to it. Something I think a lot of you use, embrace, that we can see that there's truth in other religions, that they're all pointing to the same thing. And yet, the exclusivist will say that there's only one way of doing it. The inclusivist will say, there's only one way of doing it. It just looks different. It's pretty similar. There's another way, another one that I think jaded you use, generally engage. It's not inclusivist, it's not exclusivist, it's the relativist. This is the understanding that there really isn't truth, that it all depends on situations, that we're all trying to make it up as we go along, that there's no objective reality or objective morality or objective truth. We are all just kind of creating it together. It doesn't really exist. I hear this a lot when you use talk about our faith. People will be like, oh, what do you use believe? And some people will say, oh, whatever you want. Not completely true. But being at this conference and recognizing this complete clash of cultural understandings really heightened me the importance of what I think is the true Unitarian Universalist perspective on truth, which is not exclusivist and not inclusivist and not relativist, but is pluralist. Pluralism means that there are multiple truths that sit alongside each other in a unity that we don't quite understand. That we aren't judging others based on if they are like us, but in fact, we are inviting difference in and seeing what happens when we're together. That we're trusting that your truth may be completely different than mine, but it might reveal something about the world that will make my life different. I had this professor in seminary, Charles Hallisey. He was a fascinating man. I kind of considered him like Jesus because some of his classes made no sense. A lot of them made a lot of sense. And he taught Buddhism. And I hated him for the first half of the first course I took because he would never answer questions. You'd like ask him a question and he'd be like, the other day with my daughter. And he'd just go off and tell a story about his daughter and then kind of pause, look at you, smile, and then move on. And you're like, but he told this story that has really stuck with me. He talked about being invited by a womanist book group. It was a collection of womanist theologians. Womanism is a strand of Black Christianity in which women within Black Christianity have claimed a specific way of engaging with the world and with truth. And he was invited by a group of womanist theologians to come in and help them because they wanted to explore Buddhism. They wanted to read Buddhist texts. And so he would go with them every year, and he would sit with them, and he would help them. And about 3 years into it, they asked him a question. They said, well, are we allowed to, like, is it really right for us as Black Christians to read Buddhist texts? Like, can we approach this with real integrity to understand this? And they were coming from their point of view, which was that, you know, you can't just steal things from other people, right? Black women have a huge history of things being taken from them. And so they wanted to approach this with integrity. And because Professor Hallisey is an enigma, instead of engaging on their terms, he said, well, you know, the Buddha knew that you'd be reading this text and put things in there for you. and then stopped. What I love about that story is it showcases to me the complexity of our understanding of truth, that there can be these different ways of understanding the world, and that they kind of weave into each other in weird ways, that if I take your claim of truth seriously, if I take this Buddhist perspective, then I have to take it seriously that the Buddha would have put something in there for me. Even if I'm approaching this text like a history book. The exclusivist understanding of truth smothers it. The inclusivist understanding of truth dilutes it. The relativist understanding of truth abandons it. But the pluralist reveres it, because it says that there is no way for any of us to comprehend the totality of truth, or even some of it, and that we need each other and this creative exchange between each of us to unpack and unlock this world, that each of us can maybe touch truth, but we need all of us to assemble a working hypothesis. And the beautiful thing is that with this understanding of truth, it does not mean that you have to give up your truth when you encounter me. In fact, we don't want each other to, because your unique, distinctive life experience, your unique, distinctive truth aids in my ability to experience the world. In your order of service, we have listed the five jagged rocks of Unitarian Universalism, and the first one there is that revelation is not sealed. We as Unitarian Universalists believe that truth is continuously being revealed, and it's not in ads on the paper, but it's in our own lives, and we only have parts of it, and so we need to share our truths with each other to understand it. And I think that is a beautiful thing, because sometimes I ask really ardent humanists in our congregations, why are you a member of a Unitarian Universalist congregation? Because you could go off and join a completely humanist group. Why do you want to be with Christians? Why do you want to be with Buddhists? Why do you want to be with, you know, everyone else? And then I go and ask Christians, Christian UUs, why are you a Christian UU in a Unitarian Universalist church? There are many Christian churches you could go to. And the answer I hear over and over again is that something happens to us when we are in relationship with people that are different than us, that unlocks ourselves, our world, and a way forward that is more beautiful and more life-filled than before. Even if it's messy and hard, especially in these days and ages where it is so easy for us to be in our own echo chambers, just around people who think like us, act like us, and maybe even look like us. There is a deep humility in it. And so as I was leaving the conference, because Eleanor and I, after about 45 minutes of the whole whale thing, decided we needed to leave. As we were walking back, I had to pause. And although there is something completely out of this world to think that whales are worshiping Jesus, there is something beautiful about the fact that the sound of a whale captivates me. There is something beautiful about the fact that there are so many sounds in this universe that can be woven together into eloquent, moving, stirring, jarring music. It didn't have to be like that, but it is. So maybe they're not too far off. Maybe. Amen.